Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. At tea time during the discussion that we're having, one of the things that I brought up was the importance of a quality called yoniso manasikara, which is translated in many ways, wise attention, considered attention, wise reflection. There's many ways of translating it, but it's that quality of directing attention and then being able to have a skillful assessment of the situation, have a skillful response to it, and that is particularly necessary in our Dhamma practice. One of the ways of training ourselves is to encourage that quality of reflecting carefully, paying attention in a circumspect way, because the nature of experience is such that we, without a lot of care, it's easy to just see the surface of things, see the surface of experience, and miss a bigger picture. And of course, we do that a lot. It's easy to leap to assumptions with our feelings, our emotions, our biases, our opinions, our habits, so that it just makes it that much more necessary to be very conscious of trying to cultivate this quality of yoniso manasikara. It's actually one of the qualities that the Buddha pointed to as a harbinger of the arising of the path of practice. The Eightfold Path arises when we have this quality of yoniso manasikara. And the Buddha gave the image of in the same way that when we see the light change at around the period of the dawn, then we can be confident that a new day is coming into being. In the same way that when, if we are able to establish this quality of yoniso manasikara, we could have confidence that the path of practice leading to the cessation of suffering is coming into being. There is an illustration of that, not in a psychological way, but how it plays out in the, in the world. There was a circumstance some years ago. It was in the area of the Great Lakes, between Canada and the U.S., and there's a particular kind of moth that started to appear in the forests. It wasn't a benign moth, it was this voracious moth that was eating all of the foliage of the trees, and of course then the trees were dying, and then there was a big concern over this, quite rightly so. They're seeing this happen, and then the governments get a team of scientists on the case, and a team of scientists come up with a particular strong type of pesticide that is going to deal with this particular moth, And, it took some time to research that. By that time, this moth had spread for, 100 miles or so around the Great Lakes area. And the area was so, it just expanded really quickly, and it was impossible to spray the whole area. So they did areas closer to the population areas around the edges of the lake, and it might have gone out maybe 20 miles, 30 miles at most. But by that time, this moth had spread over 100 miles out, and so these forests were devastated. But then the time passed, a few years, several years, and they started to notice that the moths were starting to die off on their own. And then the trees were starting to come back, foliage was starting to regrow, and a problem was the as that started to happen, it was regrowing in the areas where it had never been sprayed. Where it had been sprayed, then the moss had developed this. What the pesticides had done is created this super moth that was resisted. I mean, just didn't seem to die, and it just kept. It stayed there, and it probably still exists today. So it was some kind of, because of the, really there's not a huge amount of documentation of all the cycles of nature in North America. So there is probably some kind of cycle that happens in the forests in North America, and it just sort of waxes and wanes, and it's part of nature. Except now, where these super moths live, and they're still happily eating away on these trees and destroying them. I think it's a good illustration of how how we tend to react, and we experience something that's either unpleasant or a bit sort of difficult, and we kind of natural reaction of, oh my gosh, this is terrible. What am I going to do? How am I going to? And we get worked up, and we don't take the time or the care to really reflect on the circumstances and how to work with it, how to deal with it, and to give that considered response that Yoniso Manasikara provides. So the encouragement to reflect carefully on the circumstances, particularly in terms of our, of course, for us as meditators and practitioners, the importance of learning how to watch, be present with, investigate the mind, mental states, emotions. And it's just so important to have that care and circumspection with our reflection and investigation, our attention. No, and it doesn't mean that there's some kind of set response that we have to figure out. And in reality, we have to recognize that there's different appropriate responses or game plans that we can set in motion to work with. The different thoughts and thought patterns and emotional reactions that we do have. And, of course, the Buddha gave various skillful means to how to work with that. And, of course, the main thing is actually, well, what works? And there's a particular discourse where the Buddha gives skillful means for working with thoughts and thought patterns, so that one of the ways of working with it is when there's these thoughts and emotions of that are unwholesome, unskillful, could be based in desire or greed in some form of unskillful attraction, or aversion, ill will, irritation, confusion, doubt, anxiety, fear. Those are all kind of normal patterns, but they're uncomfortable, they're unpleasant, they're painful. And the Buddha, one of the ways that the Buddha advises is learning how to replace those kind of unwholesome, unskillful thoughts with what is wholesome. And not just in a kind of Pollyannish way of waving the magic wand, I'm just going to think good thoughts from now on. But really recognizing, okay, what is the particular tone or content of the thought? So what would be a useful antidote? And of course, the Buddha gives many different means of countering those kinds of thoughts of, say, of greed, of dissatisfaction, of craving. Bringing up thoughts of contentment, just really consciously looking at thoughts of contentment, of gratitude, as a counter. That's a very wholesome thought. And then to encourage the mind in that way, lifting it up consciously and experimenting and seeing what happens when we replace those thoughts. Or thoughts of irritation, aversion, ill will, to consciously bring up thoughts of loving kindness, of compassion. Those are ways they're thought patterns that undermine the unskillful and bring up a wholesome foundation within the heart. And I'd say it's a skillful means, and that one experiments. And the Buddha gives the image of a carpenter. In the old days, they didn't have nails. In the Buddha's time, didn't have nails, but they'd use like pegs of wood that you drill a hole, you put a peg in, and that's what holds the, say, boards together. And then and the Buddha sort of saying you can knock out one of the pegs with a slightly smaller peg, so you knock that out. So in the same way that one sort of knocks out the unskillful, unwholesome thoughts with the wholesome and the skillful. It's a experiment. It's something to work with, to try. Okay, does it work? How does it work? Because all of it, the whole process, is a part of the application of that wise attention. One, the wise attention to be able to recognize, well, what's happening. What is the actual difficulty here? How do I work with it? What should I try? What should I experiment with? Having experimented with something, did it actually work? So you're using this wise attention all through the process. And of course, the Buddha recognizes that, well, sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, well, you try something else. And so then the Buddha says, well, you can try reflecting on the drawback of a particular mental state. One can recognize the drawback, the difficulty, the unpleasant aspect of that. When we get caught in some kind of unskillful mental state, whatever, greed, jealousy, confusion, is sort of to be able to recollect. Well, yeah, this is inherently painful. This is uncomfortable. There's a drawback to this. If I keep obsessing the mind in this way, it increases my pain and suffering. It doesn't actually make me feel better. So that reflecting, investigating on the drawback or the painful aspect, the literal translation. The word that's used in the Thai language with that is sort of the punishment involved. So we punish ourselves with just by, yeah, say, obsessing with unwholesome thoughts, emotions, habits. So that to be able to recognize, see that more clearly. I mean, the Buddha gives a incredibly stark and maybe even gross image of, you know, in the he says, you know, just as a young man or young woman fond of, you know, fond of what is beautiful, fond of ornaments and decoration. How do we decorate our bodies? He said, just as just like that, if they had a the carcass of a dog, a snake, or something wrapped around their neck, they would be repelled, abhorred by it. And say, oh, yeah. So that one wouldn't be delighting in it. And so that in the same way, to be able to recognize those, yeah, patterns of thought, emotion that are inherently unwholesome, unskillful, and that they're a drawback. There's a disadvantage and a painful to experience, even at that time. And the Buddha also said, well, you know, if that doesn't work, you always try just not paying attention to, you know, the mind is starting to obsess over something. It's starting to get caught in a pattern of thinking that is unskillful, to just not give it one's attention. You know, which is sounds like practical advice, but the nature of the mind when it is caught up in some kind of obsession, it just loves to go there. And just it's sort of like the you know, it's like when you have poison oak and you think, okay, don't scratch, it's not good for me to scratch, and you find you're scratching away. You know, it's sort of the same thing. You think, okay, that's okay. One recognizes, oh yeah, that's not, I don't really need to be thinking about this. It isn't necessary to think about this. And you start, and the mind just starts obsessing again. It's just this. But the Buddha says, just don't give it one's attention, you know, which isn't as easy as it seems, actually. So that one has to make it quite conscious. So in the same way that something that we see that is either, you know, really upsetting or really stimulating, in an attractive way, we have to make the effort to not look, rather than sort of, you know, giving it our full attention, and you know, we have to say discipline ourselves around that, or just to withdraw attention, and so that making that quite conscious. And that withdrawing attention to the things that are unskillful, which then opens up a space for establishing attention in something that is skillful, that is helpful to one. The Buddha also gives a encouragement to direct attention to what is calming. The image that he gives is, you know, so just as if somebody who's walking along somewhere and you know, just really active, bustling along, and saying, you know, why am I walking around so like this? Why don't I, you know, I'm tired. Why don't I sit down? And I just think, yeah, well, yeah, that's, there's no real reason to bustle along, run along, wear oneself out. So that putting attention onto something that is calming, that is soothing, that is simpler than the things that are complicating and proliferating the mind. And certainly one of the best ways is coming back to the breath. I mean, it's a simple object. It's a soothing object. It's a calming object. And whether it's in formal meditation, that we consciously direct attention in that way to help soothe the thought processes, or in day-to-day activity, engagement, contact with the world around, when things are either stressful or confusing, or coming back to the rhythm of the breath, how feeling it, paying attention to it, that simplifying the objects of attention so that one's able to settle the mind, settle the heart, allow that kind of clarity to establish itself. It's something that is, it's always available. It's the attending to the breath, or say like how Ajahn Sumedho uses sound of silence as a, it's just a simple sound of a sound of stillness, of silence, of something steady, kind of in the backdrop of all the other kind of activity and contact, so that directing attention in a way that is calming. When the mind is going to diverse objects of attention, I mean, one is creating a diversity of response within the mind, within the heart. I mean, it's just natural. It's how the mind works. And when we follow that impulse of engaging in that diversity of attention, and there's just this multiplicity of moods and feelings that come up, thoughts that arise from that. So that just making a conscious effort towards calming, a calming object. And you know, there's always calming objects around if we are willing to pay attention to it. You know, it's like just being outside, and you're outside and it. You're doing something and you're getting worked up over something, getting distracted in some way. Well, just looking at a tree, looking at the sky. If you consciously pay attention to it, there's a natural settling that happens. You're in a room and just looking at the color of the walls. If it's like the walls in here in this room. I mean, it's a very neutral. It naturally settles. I heard of a particular color that they use in jails to when people are in the rooms, and it helps them to settle. I mean, they don't keep them in there very, very long, like for days. It's actually the color. The name of the color is Drunk Tank Pink. So that, it already gives the flavor of it. But this vivid pink color in jails, they have agitated drunks, calms them down for some reason. You can imagine try having some color like that in one's home. It's awful. But psychologically, they've sort of researched it, and it has an effect. So that some kind of attention towards a calming object produces that result of settling. The last thing that the Buddha pointed to as a skillful means is basically just to use endurance. Just endure the particular, say, unpleasantness of a thought or a mood. And the Buddha gave, again, a vivid description. It was just, you know, just putting one's tongue to the roof of one's palate and pressing down and holding thought at bay. It's a, you know, it's an act of will. And it's interesting that it's the very last one, because it's oftentimes it's, you know, if one is just using effort and will all the time, it's not a, there's not a, yeah, it's not a great result. But, you know, there are times when, you know, and it's not like a, just this act of repressing thoughts, but it's sort of like there's times when you know there's a real strong impulse, and you've got to, okay, I need to restrain this. This is really not skillful. This is really not to my benefit. I need to exercise restraint, and it's and there's you know there's a really strong pull there, so one has to be very conscious and willing to bear with the unpleasantness of a mood or a thought in order to allow it to pass. Because if one is really alert and watchful and attentive, I mean, that is the reality, that you know, there's no such thing as a permanent thought or a permanent mood, permanent emotion. It just isn't, it doesn't exist in this world. So that having the willingness to exercise that restraint and let it come to a place of abeyance again, or cessation. So that these are, you know, these are an array of different skillful means that one experiments with and works with and uses wise attention, uses skillful reflection. And, you know, one needs to reflect and investigate. It's a contemplation. What's going to work? What's not going to work? You know, and it's interesting to, you know, to pay attention to, you know, is that just more proliferation, or is it an actual contemplation? Is it an application of wise attention? And the way that one can recognize the difference between the two is that, you know, when the mind is just kind of proliferating, it's really not going to stop. It just keeps, it keeps finding an object of proliferation. But when one is contemplating and applying that wise attention or wise reflection, there's already an ability to stop within that. It may not be, you know, like an absolute cessation or complete, but there's an understanding of the process, and one's engaging in it in a way that one isn't obsessed with that movement of mind. It will settle, so that there's a ceasing within that. And it's important to recognize that, because we have to learn how to apply the mind. We have to learn how to use our thought processes. We have to learn how to use the reflective ability of the mind, how to work with it. Because if we're just trying to shut it off, push it away, get rid of it, you know, it's sort of like one comes up with an axiom in one's mind, and sort of, I think, therefore I suffer. And so one comes up with, say, well, if I didn't think, then I wouldn't suffer. So you end up trying to just sort of squash thought or push thought away. And, well, you're still going to suffer. So, but the learning to understand, okay, what thoughts, what patterns, what emotions lead to suffering? What leads away from suffering? What leads to the ending of suffering? what leads to the experience of peace and clarity. So that's where one needs to be able to learn how to work with thoughts and emotions, understanding them, experimenting with, what works, what doesn't work, what's the experience, what's the feeling, what's the result of one's experiments. And that's all requires that quality of yoniso manasikara, that sense of wise attention, considered attention, investigative contemplation. And that requires application of thought, so that the settling of the mind isn't accomplished just through trying to push the thoughts away or squash them down, but to work with them, understand them, have a degree of skill and interest in what works and what doesn't work. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Sadhu.